Okay, thanks, Vic. Thanks for you out there listening today. I'm Tom Gilligan here with a friend of mine that I've known for a long time. Stephanie is her name. Stephanie's been coming to Maine for about 40 years. Her granny was here and still is here, wonderfully enough. And in the meantime, Stephanie became a teacher in the big old bad city of New York City. And I think she's got a lot of interesting things to tell us about teaching and her experience, and you might find it I think you'll find it interesting, and maybe even something that'll apply for you. Okay, Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Oh, good. So, Stephanie, what did you when you went to teach in New York City schools? Did you start as an assistant, or did you go right to teaching?
I went straight to teaching.
Really? Now, were you trained as a teacher, or you just kind of inherently felt you could do that?
I was enrolled in a master's program for teaching, but most education courses don't really prepare you for the classroom, so I really was going in pretty cold. I had one class that I felt was helping me figure out what to do actually in the room, but now it's pretty much just cold.
Okay. So why don't you tell us about when you went into a classroom, how big it was, what class it was, and so on, and the difficulties or not that you encountered for the first time, if you can remember.
Well, I have spent my whole career in rather large high schools. So the school I started
Public high
at,
schools?
Public High School in Brooklyn, had about 4,000 students, and was sort of crowded. The building wasn't really designed for quite that many students. In New York City, the teachers union has set a wide range of rules that the administration must follow as part of our contract, and so class size is capped at 34. And I think in most public high school classrooms, there are 34 students because there just isn't enough room for everybody. So I had that.
That's a lot of students.
It's a lot of students. I taught my first year, I taught in several different classrooms. One was a lab room that was really big. Another one was sort of small, what you'd picture as a blackboard and ordinary desks.
Okay. So, were the students happy to see you, shall we say, or were they like trouble right from the start? I think of New York City schools as being full of rambunctious kids, but that's a stereotype that.
Well, certainly, I think I was more afraid of them than they
More
were of
afraid of
me.
that.
My first day teaching, there was a girl who sat right in the front row. She was a Haitian immigrant. I later learned that she was living in a shelter for teens because she came to New York to live with her aunt, I think. Her parents were still in Haiti, and something happened, and the aunt died or something, and so she was homeless. But I didn't know that at the time, and I had gone to a private high school, so I didn't really, I didn't have the public school thing in my experience. And I just remember her sitting in the front row, and I handed out a Delaney card, which is a way that teachers keep track of attendance, and sometimes you can put their grades on there as well. So each kid gets a little cardstock card, and they fill out their name and such, and then it goes into a special Delaney book. And I remember this kid got her Delaney card and sighed and said, "Oh, Delaney card, I've missed you."
That
And
was
it
enough.
really set the tone for my first year teaching,
Oh, wow, what a surprise.
I was so shocked that they all looked at me expectantly and
Really?
waited for instructions. I mean, I
Wow.
was
And what grade was this approximately? I guess it varied,
this was
but.
a combined. I started teaching earth science, which has really a mix of 10th, 11th, and 12th graders.
Okay.
And I remember feeling like I didn't want everyone looking at me. I was very uncomfortable being the center of attention. So I immediately got the kids busy doing things.
Good. All right. So, Steph, you mentioned you were uncomfortable with the kids looking at you, and you got them doing things? What kind of things did you get them doing?
First year was in earth science, you started out with observation and inference and density. So I went down to the lab prep room and I ordered a bunch of graduated cylinders and balances and a variety of different things. And although the room we were teaching in really did not have the, one of the rooms had those desks where you have a chair and the desk attached to it, and so it's not parallel to the floor, which meant everything was sliding around. So I had the kids all scattered around the edges of the room with their equipment set up, measuring density. And then I made a bunch of like games for them to play. I made a density puzzle, and I just tried to get them doing stuff.
Made the game on the spot, sort of improvised, or what?
Well, I drew it up. It was a series of it's supposed to look like a beaker with a series of liquids in them, and I just sort of like drew lines and, you know, made different symbols, and then they had these little mini cups drawings, and they had to use the relationships that they could figure out between densities of different liquids and these smaller ones to figure out the total.
Wow, that's a lot on the first day, isn't it?
Well, it wasn't the first day, but probably the first week.
Okay.
Yeah, first, second week.
Okay.
Oh, the other thing I do always every year is I have the kids design an experiment right away.
Oh.
And so the one
individually or a couple of them together or both?
Yeah, together. I would say I would put four kids in a group for this particular activity.
You do a lot of pairing for certain points in the class, particularly labs or otherwise? Or
yes, definitely in labs.
Could you tell
us
about that a little bit, the small groups?
Yeah, mostly for lab work, the students are usually put into groups of four, which I think is actually less than ideal. I prefer teams, too. I think that everyone should have a lab partner.
Oh.
But you need twice as much equipment to do that. And so, you know, depending on the funding of the school, you may or may not be able to do that.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's interesting. Kids can really do different things in groups of different sizes.
Yeah, it never ceases to amaze me how I get more out of doing something with somebody than by myself, and I think that the sum of the two of us is greater than the parts oftentimes, just like in an interview, hopefully.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. Next question that I can think of is, what might you do with your most challenging students? Oh, no, before we go to the problems, what did you like most about teaching, or what have you liked most about teaching? Yeah, we can come back to
it. What I like most about teaching is that it's intense. It's in the moment. It's very clearly defined by time and bells, and it's very creative. And I like that it is something collaborative, and it's never the same. So you're always, every lesson is different, even if it's the same lesson. But when you have a different group of kids, it just goes differently. And so I like that. I like that there's interaction with people. I like that I'm standing up, moving around, and that, you know, it's not a life or death situation, but you do feel kind of put on the spot and that you have to respond to whatever happens right in the moment.
Okay, cool.
And I love the kids. The kids are great.
Uh-huh, okay. So you were saying reasons why you liked it. That's great. Tell me reasons you didn't like it or don't like it.
The only thing I don't like about teaching is administrators.
Oh.
I feel that every 2-3 years there's some new pedagogical focus or something that we're supposed to do, and then, you know, we're all told to do it. And I don't think that the new initiatives that come down are as research-based and effective as the administrators try to convince us that they are. And so I have a hard time with people who don't know my subject, maybe haven't really even taught very much, but feel they can come around and tell us teachers what to do and how to do it. So I would say that's really the only challenge.
Okay.
I do, yeah. Kids are challenging.
What about interaction with parents? What do you think generally about that?
Parents?
Probably
I tend to get along okay with the parents.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's see here. Now, what do you do with your most difficult students?
Well, students can be difficult in different ways. And so one type of student that sort of raises, you know, concern is one who just is really struggling academically and really seems to be falling behind. And those students sometimes respond to different things. So, you know, you can sort of have after-school tutoring or maybe even have the kids work with other kids. And so I've sort of come up with a variety of ways to sort of address those students. But I guess the ones that are really more difficult is sort of the class clown type, the type that has to constantly be trying to get attention.
And they might try to like make you look bad or you feel like they do.
Yeah. I mean, the students that I've taught, by and large, are really, really nice. And we don't, I don't really have too many behavioral problems with them. Mm-hmm. Classroom management is what teachers call, you know, sort of dealing with the students in the room. And my classroom management is not perfect.
Okay. I hope not.
but I did have one year where these two boys were very smart, but also very dismissive of what I was doing, and they were really distracting. So I set them up with independent projects to work on during class.
Okay.
And I guess those are my most challenging kids. I try to find something that they can do on their own.
Oh, something they're interested in too, huh? Perhaps.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, good. And what about your most gifted or, you know, eager or whatever you want to say students? What do you do about that? What do you do with them usually?
I try to assign projects to students that where each student chooses their own sort of topic and their own project. And what I do there is I just try to make sure that the kids who really have a gift for science and who are really talented and fast, try to make sure that their project is challenging to them. Mm-hmm. But sometimes there are kids who I can see are not working as hard as they could. They're not doing as much as they could, but they're doing, everything is so easy for them that I can't fault their work.
Yeah.
And so that's tricky. It's like, I know this kid didn't push herself at all, but what she produced was really great. So, so that's sort of a challenge.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But I try to.
Okay. And what about the vast majority of them, somewhere in between those two groups, the most troubling and the most, I don't know, studious students, the average students, all those in between, what about them? What do you do with them?
What about them? I think most of my lessons are geared for them.
Okay.
And I have so many students that I don't really make I don't know. I try to make my class fun and interesting, and I sort of feel like that should just hit all the kids.
Okay.
Right?
In a matter
sort of get them all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So the students in between, okay, what you do with them. And what about boys versus girls, if you will, the challenges or not the challenges or the subtleties or whatever about that that you've discovered over the time that you've been there, which is what, 15 years of teaching roughly?
Yeah, 17.
17,
17
wow.
Years.
That's a bit of time.
Well, my school, which I've just left, so next year it's going to be different, but so far
another
my career,
public school.
A different public school, yeah. The school I've been in has more girls than boys, and I have taught many different courses, but mainly I've taught in these freshman honors program, where the vast majority of my students are girls. I seldom have more than 5 boys in a class, and which is interesting because, you know, honors science, we think of that as being sort of a boys thing, but girls certainly in the 9th grade tend to be more mature, they're better students, they're more conscientious, they're better able to pay attention. And boys today are facing some real challenges. I mean, cell phones and games texting your friends and stuff is also distracting for girls, but I feel like I've had more trouble getting the boys away from their devices than I have the girls.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And boys also tend to be more likely to be sort of a class clown type and to try to get attention, a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
Intellectually, though, there's no, I don't see any real difference.
Okay.
It's so really maturity level, I think.
How do you, is there a way that you might describe that you might treat boys versus girls? I mean, you try not to, but sometimes it's kind of an overly simple and stereotypical question, I guess. But
well, I don't know. I am aware. I'm quite conscious of the girls versus boys, and boys do tend to be more ready to participate, so they'll raise their hands a lot more. And I'm always careful to not call on the boys more than the girls, and to try to encourage the girls to speak up.
What about the kids that never raise their hands?
Yeah, they're tough. I like to call on what we call non-volunteers. And most of the time they will say something. And there's a variety of ways. I mean, you have to gauge sort of what kind of social anxiety is the kid experiencing. You know, I remember in high school I was very shy to raise my hand. And when I did get called on, my heart would pound. I'd break into a sweat. I wanted to hide under the desk. I mean, it was awful. And so I don't want to put a kid in that situation, but you kind of have to at the beginning just to see who the kids are, that sort of, you know, just see how they seem to feel when they're participating. And for some kids, saying something once a week is really a challenge, and other kids, you know, trying to get them to not say 25 things is a challenge too. So I try to make everybody participate at least.
Thanks for talking about the how you handle different, you know, groups and types of students. How do you teach science? Is that true?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I teach a variety of classes, but mostly biology.
Can you tell us how you chose science? Because it's not every science teacher is a woman, that's for sure. And it'd be interesting to hear how you got into science or science teaching.
It was sort of an interesting journey. When I was a kid, I was very shy, and I really preferred the company of animals to people. And so I read the books written by James Herriot. Have you read those books? James Herriot, All Things Bright and Beautiful, All Things Wise and Wonderful. He has a whole series of books, and the BBC also had a TV show series based on those books.
And her name again? I'm sorry.
James Herriot is the name. He was a countryside veterinarian in England. Most of it's set in the 30s and 40s. And he's a wonderful storyteller. So I wanted to be James Herriot. I wanted to be a farm vet. And I really wanted to take care of people's livestock and things like that. But then when I was in college, I decided that I actually liked living in a city. I went to college in Boston. And even though I'd grown up in the city, I didn't really want to live in it. And I didn't really see the draw of cities. But in college, it all changed. We started seeing bands we liked and going out to concerts, and I shifted my desire. So then I was a little bit stuck because I didn't want to neuter dogs and cats. I wasn't interested in people's pets, really. And so I was majoring in biology and just sort of continued doing that. And I expected something to come along that would grab my interest so utterly that I would pursue that as my career, but nothing did. So when I graduated, I got a job working at Rockefeller University in a lab. And I worked in a couple of labs there as a research assistant. And I felt that I was technically good. I was able to learn all the protocols in the lab and do them successfully. And I would be a very good laboratory scientist. But the real trouble was that laboratory science does not follow an academic schedule. And I spent a couple of summers working in New York City and thought, this is just awful. Here we are in Belfast having this conversation, and it's really, Maine is really the reason why I'm a science teacher. I wanted to be able to go to my camp on the lake during the summer, and I thought, well, let's think about this. I don't want to work in an office. I don't want to get dressed up. I don't want to answer phones. I'd like to be independent and have some of my own autonomy in my job, and I like to have my summers off. I planned, you know, at the time I thought I would have kids and I'd like to have the same schedule they have. And I want to be able to meet new people, because working in a lab, you really see the same five people day after day, and that's it. So I thought, and I wanted to use some of the science I'd learned. So I sort of thought, well, what can I do that will check all those boxes? And the only thing I could think of was becoming a science teacher.
That's good.
And luckily, it suits me, and I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I can tell. do some of the students get attached to you in a way that becomes... I'm sure there must be a lot of rich experiences with the students. Some become...
Yeah.
Attached. Is there such a thing as too attached sometimes to the student? Or?
Sometimes. I've had some kids kind of follow me around, call them my entourage. They come during all their free periods, you know, they follow around. I haven't had any real trouble with it, though.
You just treat it lightly.
What's interesting is that sometimes it's those very quiet students, especially girls, who don't, you know, say hardly a word the entire year, and then you find out at the end that they, you know, loved my class the best, or I helped them, you know, overcome some adolescent crisis. And it makes me, I've been reflecting recently about how much the kids learn from adults in their lives in ways that the adults don't even intend. You know, I think just my way of being a woman in the world is something that could really help a young woman trying to figure out how she wants to be in the world. And you don't even think about that when you're designing your lesson, you know?
Yeah, sometimes I'm shocked at how much I've learned by just seeing other people do it. I remember when I learned about ducks, learning from whoever seems to be their parent, I thought, well, I'm glad I'm not a duck. But then I thought, well, a certain part of me does behave like a duck. I do learn by the examples of others.
Imprinting.
So, Steph, not that any of us have the answer or anything, but if you were to speak to a new teacher, what would be your suggestions that you might give a new teacher as to how to approach a new classroom? Is that a too broad a question?
Well, no, I don't think so. There are some arts, pedagogical arts, that I would pass on to any teacher. And I sort of, it's interesting that at least in New York City, I feel like these techniques are kind of on the out. The new teachers I've met have a lot of really good techniques that they've learned and I'm impressed with, but also, I don't know, are kind of missing one of the basics. And the basics to me is, what are you going to do in the first 5 minutes of your lesson? And we use something called a motivation, which is some kind of hook to get the kids interested. And so I would stress sort of like, how do you get someone interested in a topic, in the topic of, you know, today's lesson, which may be something that isn't incredibly interesting at first glance. And I think that that's applicable in life, too. You know, every time you have to get involved in some new experience or want to try something new, sort of like, well, what would make you do that? What would get you interested? So I would say that. And then it's really important it's important for the kids to feel they sort of own the information, they own the material. And so I try to elicit as much from them as I possibly can.
Give me an example of that, please.
So, it's called a developmental lesson. You start off with some sort of, you know, hook that's maybe, for example, in earth science, when we were teaching about density and about observation and inference, I had two beakers of clear liquid, and I had ice cubes that I colored with food coloring so they could see them. And I asked them to predict what would happen if I dropped the ice cubes into the beakers. And so they all said the ice would float, and that's from their experience, right? So then you can sort of draw from the kids, well, how do you know ice floats? Why do you think it floats? You know, talk about soda or something. And then I drop the ice cubes in, and one floats and one sinks. And then we have to discuss, okay, well, what assumptions did we make at the beginning? We assumed it was water. Why did we assume it was water? And then we can discuss what we observed and what we inferred. We saw clear liquid. We saw that it was clear. We saw that it was liquid. We inferred that it was water. And then we can sort of go from there and just draw information from the students. Give them blocks that are the same size but are different density and ask them to describe what the difference is. And so I just sort of like, you have to set up your questions in such a way that each question is something that they can answer, and then based on that answer, they can get the next step. And so there's not that much explaining that I do unless it's a really complicated topic like protein synthesis or something. And I just try to get the information from the kids.
I see. And guessing if they don't have the information.
And they can guess. And there's, yeah, ways of getting every kid to feel like... The trick is, how can you get all of your students to be thinking and not just five kids thinking? The five that always want to raise their hand.
That sounds very challenging.
And that really is the challenge that we face, yeah.
Can you give an example of how you might have succeeded with that or not succeeded?
Yeah. So one way of doing it is to set up the expectation in your classroom that you're going to call on kids whether or not they're raising their hand, so that every kid feels a little bit anxious, like, well, they better have something to say. I'm sort of okay at that, but I'm not great at it. The other way to do it is to have the students discuss the question before you ask for answers. So we, even just with the kid next to them, I give them a specific question or maybe a couple of images that they have to discuss. And now they've spent, it could just be 90 seconds. 90 seconds discussing it, you'll get many, many more kids willing to share their answer. So that's a very powerful way of doing that.
Okay.
Yeah. I like timing. I like getting out of a stopwatch and timing the kids. That's something I find makes them spring into action. If they've only got 60 seconds, you know, to discuss something or come up with an answer.
Yeah, I've thought oftentimes that pressure and tension are underrated as a plus. For myself, I need that to focus, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. When I wait too long, it's interesting. You have to wait long enough. You have to give the kids long enough to think it through.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to give kids time to do that. And some kids will finish it in 10 seconds. They'll have their ready answer. But other kids might need a minute.
Okay.
So there is something where you have to give them time, but if you give them too much, then they all lose focus and they're off just, you know, doodling and fidgeting and whatever.
Good.